This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
Trump has to prove that he can be president, and he has to prove to a lot of the people who are looking at him that he can be as assertive and as aggressive as he wants to be. Kamala Harris has to prove that she's presidential. She has to prove that she can attack and she can pull back.
That's Nate French, communications instructor at Wake Forest University, on tonight's debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. Details coming up also. The man accused of killing a Ugandan Olympic athlete has died. And Lake Victoria, the largest lake in Africa, has become a convergence point for organized crime. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. As the death toll in Sudan's war rises to more than 20,000 people, United Nations-backed human rights investigators call for the creation of an independent and impartial force to protect civilians. The investigators accuse both sides, the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, of war crimes against civilians and said a ceasefire is needed immediately. But Sudan's government has rejected the deployment of an outside force to protect millions of civilians after more than 16 months of war. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, discussed the conflict and the struggle to reach a ceasefire with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It's a very difficult position, and it's unfortunate that the Sudanese government has refused an independent external intervention force to try and keep these two belligerent groups separate. The government of General Burhan is still very insecure around the question of sovereignty. Bringing in a foreign intervention force will show that the government is failing in its number one duty to provide for the security of the property and lives of the Sudanese. I think the other challenge with foreign intervention force would also be who would constitute this force, what would their mandate be, and how should they engage when they would be attacked by either the forces of the RSF or the forces of the Al-Burhan administration. So essentially, General Burhan is really afraid about giving up the sovereignty of Sudan and the autonomy that he has in that process. And it's unfortunate because it seems that this humanitarian crisis will continue.
U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perelio, started a tour to Riyadh, Cairo, and Ankara to continue urgent efforts to end the war and famine in Sudan, building on the recent success of the Aligned for Advancing Life-Saving and Peace in Sudan initiative. Diplomatic priorities continue to include the coordination of efforts to urge the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF to expand humanitarian access in Sudan to ensure the protection of civilians in and seeking the cessation of hostilities. What else could these countries plus the United States do to achieve these goals?
I think they could put diplomatic pressure on both parties, whether the RSF or the Sudanese army, to get to the negotiating table and declare some kind of ceasefire. They can have some kind of arms embargo in terms of the weapons that are coming into these countries. I think they can have travel bans on the top players in both the RSF and the Sudanese government. But I think lastly, they can impose sanctions or threat of sanctions on the Sudanese government should it be resistant to diplomatic efforts. So I think there's a lot they can do, not only diplomatically, but also in terms of access to funds, banking abroad, overseas, and also trade of Sudan and the players in the conflict with, you know, foreign countries. There's a lot that they can still do to put pressure on both factions.
The United Nations World Food Programme said on Sunday that Sudan's war for more than 500 days exposed half the population to extreme hunger. The World Food Programme announced the entry of food aid to West Darfur with the aim of combating the threat of famine in Sudan. Is this enough to avoid a devastating famine in Sudan?
I think it's a temporary measure that can alleviate or postpone a devastating famine in Sudan because it's a temporary, it's like a stopgap measure. Particularly, remember the fact that this is a food aid to West Darfur, where the RSF rebels are located. I think the challenge for the World Food Program providing this food aid will be to essentially ensure that the food is secure, that it actually gets to the starving civilians that need it the most. Because part of the challenge and the complexity of this conflict is if that food aid gets into the hands of the rebels or the government forces, it is actually contributing to perpetuation of the conflict because it will be aiding the parties in the conflict that really don't need this aid. I think the other element that the World Food Program should carefully consider is how to integrate food aid, but also to support peace initiatives, which will allow Sudanese farmers to actually grow food and allow Sudan to be self-sustaining in terms of food production.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump square off tonight in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate. Analysts say the rhetorical slugfest, which pits the prosecutorial puncher against one of America's best-known counter-punchers, could be decisive as they vie for the presidency. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
In the Republican corner, former President Donald Trump, trying to reclaim the title after a four-year break. And in the Democrat corner, Vice President Kamala Harris, the rising challenger who has Americans wondering whether she can go the distance all the way to the Oval Office. Tuesday evening's presidential debate, with its glossy production values, pre-event taunts, and starkly different contenders, feels like a heavyweight bout. Trump's last debate ended with a knockout. Just weeks after President Joe Biden's lackluster late June debate performance against Trump, Biden announced he would not seek re-election. Now, with Harris just weeks into running as his replacement, she faces Trump on the debate stage. But analysts say it's more than a spectacle. This toe-to-toe contest, where both will vie for points from a deeply split electorate, could be decisive. They bring very different styles to the stage. Trump has jabbed at Harris's intelligence and predicts that his odds against her are better than against his last debate opponent, Biden.
He is a smarter person than she is. Oh, they're waiting for the debate.
And here's Harris taking a short break from debate training.
Look, it's time to turn the page on the divisiveness. It's time to bring our country together, chart a new way forward.
June's Trump-Biden debate drew more than 51 million U.S. television viewers. Analysts expect big numbers for this matchup, too, and high stakes for both contenders. Nate French teaches communications at Wake Forest University.
Trump has to prove that he can be president, and he has to prove to a lot of the people who are looking at him that he can be as assertive and as aggressive as he wants to be without being rude if he's going to try to get anybody that might not be currently on the Trump train. Kamala Harris has to prove that she's presidential. She has to prove that she can attack and she can pull back. She has to prove that she can identify where her policies are different than Biden, but still moving in the same Democratic platform.
Moderators will pepper the candidates with questions on major issues like the economy, reproductive rights, foreign policy, and more. Each candidate, given only a pen, paper, and water, has 2 minutes to reply. Jeremy Suri is a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
To some extent, the debates give the two candidates a pass because they can state the things they want to do, their aspirations, without having to explain how they will do them. But where it becomes significant is they have to at least say, when they articulate their positions, what they think that will look like.
It all happens here in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, on Tuesday night. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
VOA national correspondent Steve Herman is in Philadelphia to cover the debate, which is produced by ABC News. He's on the line now for more on the debate. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Steve.
A pleasure to be here.
So I understand that many U.S. political analysts think this debate is more important for Harris than for Trump. Why is that?
Well, that's because just about everybody in the United States, including voters, know Donald Trump from his 4 years as president. But about 30% of voters have told pollsters that they want to know more about Kamala Harris. Yes, she's been vice president for 4 years. Yes, she had a brief presidential run in 2019, but they're definitely not as familiar with her as they are with Donald Trump. So thus, there's more pressure on her to come across and sway some of these independent voters to vote for her to come out in this presidential election.
So Election Day, November 5th, is approaching fast. Some states will soon begin early voting. How does that factor into the importance of this debate?
Yes, we already have a couple of states that the ballots have gone out and people are now eligible to vote early. But by the end of next week, I think it's about 16 states or so that will be in the early voting phase. So this is probably the last significant event before we get into a good chunk of the early voting, or maybe even Election Day itself, where there's going to be a lot of publicity about these two candidates, and probably this performance tonight could do as much as anything else to sway just a small number of voters in these seven or so swing states that will determine the outcome of the election.
And finally, Steve, can you give us a sense of the scene there in Philadelphia, the debate venue? What is the security like? Are journalists already setting up?
Well, the journalists will all be in a media center adjacent to where the debate is being held because there's going to be no audience for this debate, just the moderators in the room, some technicians, camera operators, lighting folks, and the candidates. So thousands of journalists and surrogates of the candidates will be nearby, and we'll have them coming out in a spin room after the debate to tell all these journalists that, of course, their candidate did better than the other. And yes, there is a big security cordon, and we've gotten used to that because we've just recently had the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee and the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And this is meant not only to ensure security, but to keep protesters a good distance away from where the action is.
VOA national correspondent Steve Herman in Philadelphia covering the debate. Thank you for your input.
You are most welcome.
The U.S. presidential debate happens Tuesday night on American Network ABC, and you can hear it right here on VOA Africa. Join me, Carol Van Damme, and my co-host, Chinedu Afor, as we discuss with seasoned analyst what's at stake as Vice President Kamala Harris squares off against former President Donald Trump in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for their first debate ever before the November election. Tune in 30 minutes before the debate with our live coverage at 0030 UTC and after the debate for analysis.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yehiyas Wuhib, in Washington. We'd love to hear from you so you can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. Several agencies say Lake Victoria, the largest lake in Africa, has become a convergence point for organized crime. Researchers say criminals are targeting weaknesses in the security operations of Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to exploit Lake Victoria's ecosystem for profit. Darren Taylor reports.
The Lake Victoria Fisheries Organization says the water sustains 200,000 fisherfolk, with an estimated 40 million people depending on it for food. South Africa's Institute for Security Studies, the ISS, says fish stocks and livelihoods are threatened by criminal gangs. It estimates that almost half of all fishing that happens on Lake Victoria is illegal. Nelly Kerebi, fish biologist at Kenya's Fisheries Service, says the lake's being overfished like never before.
In the past years, most of the vessels that were being used for fishing in the Lake Victoria were mainly paddle-driven or wind sails, but now we can see that technology has improved and we've moved on to engine-powered vessels. Also, the manpower that is going into the lake in the form of fishermen has greatly increased throughout the years.
Senior ISS researcher Dr. Willis Okumu says criminal syndicates also are removing a lot of sand from lake shores.
Along the shores of Lake Victoria, a lot of breeding areas for fish have been destroyed due to the demand for sand. And most of this sand is actually used for construction purposes across Western Kenya region, part of Eastern Uganda, and also in parts of Tanzania. There are Chinese actors that are collaborating with locals in Kenya and Uganda that are actually exporting some of this sand across to the port of Mombasa.
He says timber smuggling is also increasing.
A lot of forests within the islands of Lake Victoria have been decimated. A lot of some of these trees that were even used for the manufacture of boats are getting extinct because of unregulated harvesting of some of this forest within the lake. A lot of charcoal that is used along the shores of Lake Victoria in Kenya and Tanzania is actually coming from Uganda. And most of this is actually transported through the lake into the islands and also into the inland. We have had cases of boats capsizing in Lake Victoria. The latest one, I think, was in 2023, when 11 people were actually killed when the boat capsized, having carried over 100 bags of charcoal across into Kenya.
Okumu says criminal gangs pay locals to help them evade law enforcement.
The fisher folk are first very, very knowledgeable about the lake. At times, they're hired. They're actually called consultants because of their navigation experience, because they know the lake, they know the geography of the place. They are actually used, they use their boats for smuggling of timber, they use their boats for illegal fishing, and therefore they are very much involved in all sorts of illegalities as they look for genuine livelihood within the lake.
The ISS says some government officials managing Lake Victoria accept bribes from criminals, allowing unregistered boats onto the water and turning a blind eye to crimes. Karebi acknowledges corruption's a problem. She agrees there aren't enough patrol vessels on the lake and there's poor coordination among Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda when it comes to managing the lake's resources.
We also have the issue of the different regulations among the three countries. You find that regulations in Uganda are different, regulations in Kenya are different. Even amongst ourselves, we also have the issue of overlapping mandates. You'd find that between our agency and another agency, we have the same mandate. So you find someone visiting a fisherman today, the other agency has gone there tomorrow, so it becomes quite hectic.
Karebi says it's time for Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda to thrash out a common management policy for Lake Victoria and to forge anti-crime strategies that can be implemented by all three countries. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A Kenyan hospital says a man accused of killing a Ugandan Olympic athlete by dousing her with gasoline and setting her ablaze has succumbed to burns sustained in the attack. Dixon Ndiema was admitted at the Moi Referral Hospital in Eldore City in western Kenya for burns covering 30% of his body. He is alleged to have sustained the injuries after setting on fire Olympic athlete Rebecca Cheptegei, who died last Thursday after suffering burns over 80% of her body. The Associated Press reports that the athlete's father says the suspect, his daughter's former boyfriend, was stalking and threatening her, and the family had informed police. Ndiema and Cheptegei were said to have quarreled over a piece of land the athlete bought in Kenya to be near several athletic training centers. Cheptegei competed in the marathon in last month's Paris Olympics, finishing 44th. MIP Africa, an event that matches African film and TV creative artists to the people and countries that produce their work, wrapped up recently with several signed deals. Industry members and legislators from film meccas worldwide attended the event, part of the larger Fame Week Africa conference for creative professionals. Reporter Vicky Stark has the story from Cape Town, South Africa.
U.S. superstar comedian and producer Steve Harvey was a headliner last week at MIP Africa, a networking event that brings African TV and filmmakers together with the business people and countries that help bring their dreams to the screen. Harvey shared insights about his career in a hosted conversation. Harvey has also partnered with the Botswana government to set up a training academy called Botswana Ignite to advance the country's TV and film industry.
Look, South Africa and Nigeria have a jump on everything. You know, they're doing quite well. But there are a lot of countries on this continent who could use some help.
A 2021 UNESCO report found that Africa's film and audiovisual industries employed about 5 million people and accounted for $5 billion in gross domestic product across the continent. The study said the industry could eventually grow to employ 20 million and contribute $20 billion to the GDP. Nigerian Indian filmmaker Hamisha Daryani Ahuja is one of the creatives making a mark. Her debut film, Namaste Wahala, brings two of the world's movie-producing hotspots, India's Bollywood and Nigeria's Nollywood, together. When it was released on Netflix in 2021, the interracial romantic comedy was ranked number 6 on the platform worldwide.
The Nigerian industry is doing fantastic at the moment. I think it's actually following the trajectory of where Bollywood was some years ago. We have similar issues that Mumbai and the Bollywood industry faced, such as internet issues, Wi-Fi, and all of that has changed.
Several attendees VOA spoke to said streaming platforms like Netflix and Showmax, which buy work from African creatives, have been a game changer. Lonwabo Mavuso, co-founder and executive director of research company Andani Africa, spoke about transformation on a panel that promoted building ties with Atlanta. The American city boasts a proud history of black entrepreneurship. Mavuso's firm did a study for South Africa's National Film and Video Foundation in which they compared data on industry employment for the country from 2004 to 2021.
And there's been a 300% increase in terms of black employment in the film and TV industry. However, of that stat, a lot of those jobs still sit within sort of low-ranking jobs and with very limited influence in terms of decision-making.
While FameWeek Africa marketing manager Stephen Beckett wouldn't say how many deals were signed during MIP Africa, he said the event was bigger than last year.
Just over 7,000 recorded meetings taking place at MIP Africa. And obviously this is just a sign of the growth and the necessity within the industry.
FameWeek Africa also includes the Muziki Africa Music Industry event, the Cape Town International Animation Festival, a Shorts Film Festival, and the Africa Fashion Forum. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
And Senegal's navy says it has intercepted two large canoes carrying more than 420 illegal migrants a day after a boat sank off the coast of the West African country, killing more than 20. The navy said on social media that 20 children were among the 421 people picked up by a naval offshore patrol vessel yesterday. The French news agency AFP reports that the Navy did not say when it stopped the two large motorized open canoes or what nationality the passengers were. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrias Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.